So, you know that ultimate, universally understood pit in your stomach nightmare. I mean, we've all lived some version of it, right?
No, for sure.
It's Monday morning. You wake up, and the light filtering through your blinds just looks, well, a little too bright, like a little too far into the day.
Yeah, that specific angle of the sun that just screams you're late.
Right. And you glance at your phone, and it's 7:01 a.m. But your alarm was set for 5. So you've completely slept through it. The 6:30 train you were supposed to be on is long gone, and your commute is entirely ruined.
And your boss is just, they're already looking for reasons to criticize your performance.
Oh yeah, they're gonna be furious. Your heart rate spikes, the adrenaline just hits your bloodstream like ice water, and you're trapped in this highly specific but utterly mundane panic.
It's the sheer terror of failing your economic obligations. I mean, that cold sweat, it's a byproduct of living in a society where your worth is just tied to your punctuality.
Right.
The fear is less about the missed train itself, you know? It's more about the implication that you're a faulty cog in the machine.
Which is bad enough. But now imagine you're having that exact same workplace panic attack, but as you go to like throw the covers off, you realize you can't move your arms.
Yeah, minor complication there.
Right. You look down, and overnight, your body has transformed into a giant, horrifying vermin. You've got this hard, armor-like back. A brown domed
Are
belly.
provided by stiff sections, yeah.
Yeah, and you have dozens of these pitifully thin little legs just waving helplessly in the air right before your eyes.
I mean, in any normal narrative, the psychological reaction to that would be sheer cosmic terror. The protagonist would question their sanity or pray or, you know, just scream until their lungs gave out.
But the cognitive dissonance here, the true horror that Kafka introduces, is that the most pressing issue on this creature's mind is still, how am I going to explain this tardiness to the office?
Yeah, why is a guy who just woke up with a hard shell and dozens of little waving legs completely obsessed with the fact that his early train left without him?
Like, what does that actually reveal about how we prioritize our jobs over our own physical bodies? We talk about modern hustle culture and burnout today, like they're these newly invented concepts, right?
Oh, yeah, tailored for the digital age or
Right.
whatever.
But this text was written over a century ago.
It immediately establishes this bleak hierarchy of fears. The loss of humanity is entirely secondary to the loss of employment, which is, you know, primary.
It really is.
It sets up this incredibly dark lens through which we have to view the whole story. Like, we're forced to ask whether Gregor Samsa was ever truly treated as human in the first place.
Or if he was just an economic tool that suddenly broke down.
Yeah.
Well, our mission today is to guide you through this Clara and Horatio companion conversation for Franz Kafka's The Metamorphosis. We're exploring the David Whaley translation to look at why this story remains such a shocking, darkly comedic, and, well, tragic mirror to our own lives.
And to really understand the psychological pressure cooker Kafka builds here, we gotta first map out the claustrophobia of the setting. I mean, the entire narrative is confined to a single flat in Charlottenstrasse.
We literally never leave the apartment until Gregor is dead.
Right. The architectural layout is basically a physical manifestation of his entrapment. It's this cramped environment lit by pale electric street lamps and indoor gaslights.
And there's a live-in maid, at least at the beginning, right?
Yeah, and this relentless, dreary view of a hospital across the narrow street. Just think about the weight of that visual anchor for a second.
That's so bleak.
Whenever Gregor looks out his bedroom window, trying to find some comfort or a connection to the outside world, he just sees this endless gray-black building with an austere, regular line of windows.
A hospital, a place of sickness and institutionalization just staring right back at him.
Yeah, it completely reflects his own sudden infirmity. And the society operating outside that window is defined by these strict, almost suffocating hierarchies.
Right, like we have traveling salesmen who are at the absolute bottom rung of the commercial ladder,
Yeah.
just treated with constant suspicion.
And on the flip side, you have these terrifying chief clerks who literally do house calls if an employee misses a single train. The whole culture is just built on surveillance and distrust.
Which makes the genre dynamics at play here so unusual. Kafka forces this collision between absurd, magical realism. I mean, a guy turning into a bug in hyper-realistic domestic drama.
But the domestic drama is almost agonizingly petty.
Yeah, it really is.
The family doesn't react to this supernatural event with philosophical awe. They don't call a priest or a scientist or anything. They react to it as a logistical and financial inconvenience.
Like, how are we going to pay the rent?
Exactly. Or how do we hide the kitchen garbage from the people renting the spare bedroom? The fantastical element is just treated as a frustrating hurdle to their middle-class aspirations.
And understanding this financially stressed, status-obsessed household is really the only way to comprehend how the family reacts to Gregor's change. We tend to talk about this book as a sequence of tragic events, but it's really a map of shrinking geography and eroding utility.
Let's trace how Kafka orchestrates that loss of space and status. Because the inciting incident isn't the transformation itself, right? That already happened before the first sentence.
Yeah, the inciting incident is the missed train. Gregor is just lying in bed, trying to rationalize his new anatomy. He's actually trying to convince himself it's just a delusion or like an occupational hazard of being on the road.
It's such a great detail. He turns into a giant insect, and his first instinct is to blame it on a cold coming on from bad hotel food.
Right. But his immense denial gets shattered because his family realizes he's still home, which is entirely unprecedented. I mean, he hasn't been sick once in 5 years of service.
So they start knocking. You've got his mother at one door, his father at another, and his sister Greet at a third.
The layout there is brilliant. His room has doors on three sides. So he's literally boxed in by his family's expectations. He has no wall to put his back against that doesn't have a family member demanding something from him.
And the intrusion quickly escalates from just domestic concern to a full-on corporate invasion. The chief clerk from his firm arrives at the flat.
Just because Gregor missed the 5 o'clock train? And it's barely past 7 in the morning at this point.
The micromanagement is just suffocating. The chief clerk is standing outside the door, accusing Gregor of neglecting his duties, dropping hints that Gregor might have stolen money, and threatening his position.
Which forces Gregor to attempt the impossible. I mean, he manages to swing his heavy, cumbersome dome out of bed, drags himself to the wooden door, and actually turns the key in the lock using nothing but his insect jaws.
And the physical toll of that is immense. There's this brown fluid dripping from his mouth onto the floor as he basically damages his own mouth to unlock the door.
And the reveal is just catastrophic. The chief clerk covers his mouth and starts slowly backing away. Gregor's mother steps forward, then collapses, sinking entirely into her skirts on the floor.
And then the father's reaction really sets the violent tone for the rest of the text. At first, he just covers his eyes and weeps so hard his powerful chest shakes.
But as the chief clerk flees down the stairs in a blind panic, the father just weaponizes his fear. He grabs the clerk's abandoned walking stick, picks up a newspaper, and starts driving Gregor back into his room.
Stamping his feet and hissing at him like a wild animal.
Yes, the hissing. It's such a vital psychological shift.
Because the father instantly strips Gregor of his humanity right there. He makes no attempt to communicate, no attempt to comfort his son. He just treats him purely as a dangerous pest.
He physically shoves Gregor through this narrow doorway, which badly injures his flank. It leaves these vile brown flecks on the white door before he just slams it shut.
So the primary breadwinner is instantly demoted to a monster locked in a bedroom, and that initiates a massive shift in the household economy.
Right, because initially, Gregor's younger sister, Greet, steps into the role of sole caretaker. She realizes he can't tolerate the fresh milk he used to love, so she curates this whole smorgasbord of rotting vegetables, old cheese, and dry bread just to test his new palate.
Greet's early response shows this mix of horror, but also profound empathy. She's the only one brave enough to cross the threshold of his room. She even notices that Gregor enjoys crawling on the walls and the ceiling.
So she tries to remove the furniture to give him more vertical space to roam.
Right. But the reality of their financial ruin just crushes that brief period of caretaking. I mean, Gregor had been financially carrying the entire family.
Yeah, with his income gone, they're forced right back into the labor market. The father, who had been lazily retired for 5 years, gets a job as a bank messenger.
The mother, who has severe asthma, starts sewing underwear for a fashion shop.
And Greet, who is only 17, takes this grueling sales job and is studying shorthand and French late into the night.
So as the family's physical and emotional exhaustion deepens, Gregor just transitions from a tragedy to a neglected burden. The empathy evaporates, and it's replaced by the simmering resentment.
They actually stop seeing him as Gregor and begin referring to him exclusively as it.
Which culminates in the apple attack. The mother and sister are trying to clear the furniture from his room, and Gregor panics because he feels like they're erasing his last ties to a human existence.
So he breaks cover to protect a framed picture on his wall. His mother catches sight of him and faints. And Greet, who's furious now, shakes her fist at him.
Which is her first act of direct hostility since the transformation.
Yeah. Then the father comes home from work, sees the chaos, and assumes Gregor has physically attacked the mother.
Yeah.
So wearing this stiff blue bank uniform with gold buttons, the father starts bombarding Gregor with apples from a fruit bowl on the dining table.
And he throws them with lethal, calculated force. One apple actually penetrates Gregor's armor and lodges deep in his back.
It's a deeply symbolic, festering wound, and no one dares to extract it. It just stays lodged in his flesh for over a month, surrounded by this inflamed area covered in white dust. It renders him a permanent invalid, barely able to drag himself across the floor.
And from that point on, the demise is agonizingly slow. The family has to rent a room to three bearded, incredibly strict gentlemen just to generate income.
And these lodgers demand absolute cleanliness, which means Gregor's room becomes the dumping ground for all the household refuse. Dust bins, old furniture, ash. They just toss it all in with Gregor.
He stops eating. He just sits in the darkness, covered in dust, threads, and stray hairs. Then we reach the final breaking point.
Greed is playing the violin in the kitchen. The lodgers invite her to perform in the living room. Gregor, who is just starved for beauty and connection, is drawn out of his isolation by the music.
He creeps into the living room, entirely filthy, trailing food remnants.
And the lodgers spot him. But notably, they aren't even terrified. They're just deeply annoyed by the unsanitary conditions of the apartment.
Right. They immediately give notice, refusing to pay their rent and threatening a lawsuit against the father.
And that's when Greed finally snaps. The sister, who used to carefully select his meals, turns to her parents. She says they must try and get rid of it.
She argues they've done all that's humanly possible. She refuses to call the creature her brother anymore. She rationalizes that if this bug were truly Gregor, he would have had the decency to leave of his own free will to spare them the burden.
And Gregor hears this entire rationalization. He comprehends that he is completely unwanted. So with immense, painful effort, he crawls back into his room, great slams the door and locks it, yelling, "At last!" in relief.
Gregor, lying in the dark, feels his physical pain slowly fade. He thinks of his family with deep emotion and love, and as the clock strikes 3 a.m, his head sinks down and his breathing stops.
He literally starves himself to death to free them from the economic and social burden of his existence. It's heartbreaking, and the aftermath is just chilling. The charwoman discovers his dry, flat corpse in the morning, poking it with a broom to confirm it's dead.
And when she announces the news, Mr. Samsa simply says, "Let's give thanks to God for that."
They're immensely relieved. They evict the lodgers immediately, fire the charwoman who disposed of the body, and leave the flat together for the first time in months.
The story concludes with the parents looking at Greed on a sunny tram ride, noticing she's grown into a beautiful young woman, and silently agreeing it's time to find her a husband.
Which is wild. But you know, when modern listeners approach this audiobook, they often come in with preconceived notions. They expect a grim, terrifying horror story akin to Poe or like modern body horror. And because they brace for terror, they completely miss the dark comedy woven into the text.
Oh, the opening pages are structurally hilarious. It really functions as pure farce. You have a man who has undergone a reality-breaking metamorphosis, and his internal monologue reads like a disgruntled HR complaint.
Exactly. He's lying there looking at his many pitifully thin legs, waving helplessly, and his thought process isn't, "Am I a demon? Have I been cursed by a vengeful god?"
Mm-hmm.
His thought process is, "What a strenuous career I've chosen. Bad and irregular food, worrying about train connections."
He is furious about the logistics of his job.
Yes. He even fantasizes about marching up to his boss and telling him off, claiming the boss would fall right off his desk from the shock. The cognitive dissonance between his physical reality and his psychological reality is just a masterclass in absurdist humor.
Kafka is completely satirizing the relentless suspicion of the corporate machine.
I read this again recently, getting ready for this companion conversation, and I was actually laughing out loud at the physical comedy. He spends pages trying to figure out how to get out of bed.
Yeah, he realizes he can't roll to the right because of his domed shell.
So he tries to rock himself out. He thinks, if I just had two strong people, like my father and the maid, they could just push their arms under my dome and swing me onto the floor. He's treating his horrific new body like a heavy piece of mahogany furniture. He needs to pivot down a hallway.
And he's terrified of calling in sick because he reasons that in 5 years, he hasn't been ill once. Mm-hmm. If he calls in, the boss will bring the medical insurance doctor who will just accuse his parents of having a lazy, work-shy son.
Right. Any human frailty is viewed as a moral failing by the system he works for.
Which brings us to the financial trap. This detail is really the engine of the entire tragedy. Why is Gregor working this soul-crushing job in the first place?
Because he's working to pay off his parents' debt to his current boss. Gregor mentions he needs another 5 or 6 years to clear that debt before he can quit.
He's essentially indentured to his family's past financial failures.
He surrendered his own autonomy to save them. He worked with this fiery vigor, rising from a junior salesman to a traveling representative overnight, just so he could throw cash on the table and delight his family. He derived his entire sense of self-worth from providing for them.
But that dynamic created an incredibly toxic foundation. When he was the golden goose, the family accepted the money with gratitude. But as the narrator notes, there was no longer much warm affection given in return. The love became entirely transactional.
Now, here is where I kind of push back a little. I have a real problem with how modern readings sometimes want to flatten the family into evil, greedy caricatures. It's too easy to say they are just parasites.
Mm.
The text shows us they are profoundly exhausted. The tragedy is that everyone is trapped, not just Gregor.
Yeah, Kafka doesn't write cartoon villains. The family's suffering is highly palpable. The mother has severe asthma. Simply moving around the house leaves her gasping for breath on the sofa.
Right.
And the father is elderly, clumsy, and was forced into a humiliating retirement after his business collapsed.
And Greet was just a 17-year-old kid. Her life before this consisted of wearing nice clothes, sleeping late, and playing the violin. Suddenly, she's thrust into the role of primary caregiver to a monster while also working a demanding retail job.
The sheer physical toll of 1915 domestic labor. I mean, hauling coal, scrubbing floors without modern appliances while starving is enough to break anyone.
The real monster in the text isn't the bug. It's the financial desperation that forces humans to evaluate each other solely based on economic utility.
The system leaves no margin for grace, no room for severe illness, and no capacity for unconditional care. Once Gregor stops producing capital, he becomes a drain on their highly limited resources. Their empathy is simply starved out of them by poverty and exhaustion.
And that exhaustion creates literal walls in the house. The architectural isolation is terrifying. Have you noticed how obsessed this family is with locking doors?
Oh, yeah.
The physical barriers map perfectly onto the emotional barriers.
In the very first scene, Gregor actually congratulates himself on his cautious habit, acquired from traveling, of locking all his doors at night, even in his own home.
He voluntarily isolates himself before he even turns into a bug. He built his own cage.
And once he transforms, the doors become a symbol of the breakdown in empathy. When he attempts to speak to his family through the wood, his human voice is fading.
It starts clear, but it's infected with this painful, uncontrollable squeaking from deep inside him. The text describes it as an echo that makes the words unclear, leaving the hearer unsure if they heard properly. It's agonizing.
His family thinks he's merely being stubborn while he is desperately trying to articulate his loyalty.
The doors are eventually bolted from the outside. The closed doors symbolize the complete severance of understanding between Gregor and the human world.
He's completely starved for connection in that locked room. Which brings us to the scene with the picture of the lady in fur. He could have saved his writing desk. He could have saved the tools of his past human intellect. Instead, he risks his life to save a magazine cutout.
Yeah, Greet and the mother decide to clear out his furniture to give him room to crawl. Gregor realizes that by taking away his writing desk, they are abandoning the hope that he'll ever return to being human. He panics.
He breaks out of his hiding spot under the couch, scrambling to save something. And he targets a picture of a lady fitted out with a fur hat and a fur boa that he recently cut out of an illustrated magazine and framed.
He scurries up the wall and presses his hot, sticky belly against the cool glass of the frame. He is willing to fight his sister for it. He actually thinks to himself that he would rather jump at Greet's face than let her take it. But why this specific picture?
Well, the image represents his connection to human culture, to art, to sexuality, to desire. It's a relic of the life he was supposed to lead but never had time for because of his debts. Pressing his insect body against the glass is a desperate attempt to physically hold on to a scrap of his human dignity.
He's refusing to let them turn his room into a mere cave.
Exactly. And that sensual deprivation extends to what he consumes. You can trace the entire decay of the family's affection simply by tracking the sensory descriptions of his food.
Yeah, on the first evening, he wakes up to find a dish of sweetened milk with pieces of white bread floating in it, which was his favorite drink as a human. It demonstrates that Greet is still thinking of him as her human brother, but his biology has changed and it tastes repulsive to him.
So Greet adapts. She brings him a wide selection on an old newspaper. The descriptions here are incredibly visceral. half-rotten vegetables, bones covered in congealed white sauce, and cheese that he had declared inedible 2 days prior.
His eyes literally water with pleasure as he sucks on the rotting cheese.
Initially, Greet serves this decaying food with clinical, careful attention. But as the months drag on and her retail job drains her, she stops caring what he wants.
She just hurriedly pushes any random food into his room with her foot in the morning and sweeps it out in the evening, completely indifferent to whether he ate it.
Eventually, he just takes food into his mouth, plays with it for hours, and spits it out. He starves amidst the garbage. The physical starvation maps perfectly onto the starvation of their love for him.
While Gregor is devolving into an invalid insect, eating garbage, the father is experiencing this intense, almost frightening resurrection. I read the father's arc as a reverse metamorphosis.
Yeah, Gregor described his father before the transformation as a tired man entombed in his bed. He would receive Gregor sitting in an armchair in his nightgown, hardly able to stand up. He shuffled slowly, heavily relying on his walking stick. He was a defeated man.
But the moment Gregor is incapacitated, the father is forced back into the world. When Gregor sees him weeks later, he doesn't even recognize him.
The text describes him standing up straight, dressed in a smart blue uniform with gold buttons from the banking institute. His strong double chin emerges from a stiff collar. His eyes are piercing and alert.
The father reclaims his patriarchal power and his economic utility. But his uniform, which slowly becomes stained and shabby from being slept in, shows the cost of this transformation.
He stubbornly refuses to take it off, slumbering in his chair, fully dressed, looking highly uncomfortable but peaceful, as if he's always ready to serve his superior. He's regained his strength, but he's become institutionalized.
And he uses this reclaimed power to violently subjugate Gregor. The father's resurrection requires the son's destruction. They are on a grim seesaw. As one rises, the other must fall.
You know, listening to the Clara Naurashio version of this text shifts the entire texture of the story. Reading the words on a page allows you to control the pacing, but experiencing this through audio makes you realize Kafka constructed a profoundly acoustic nightmare.
On paper, it feels very visual. In audio, the silence versus the noise is jarring. You feel the relentless march of the ticking clock on his chest of drawers dictating his life in the opening pages.
And you hear the terrifying change in his voice. The narrator describing that uncontrollable squeaking mixed with human words makes the loss of his humanity visceral.
We must also pay attention to the heavy, highly polished boots of the chief clerk marching into the adjoining room. It's the literal sound of authority invading the domestic safe space.
We hear the father hissing, reducing himself to an animalistic state to combat his son. We hear the obnoxious whistling of the charwoman who just treats Gregor's existence like a joke.
And the climax of the entire narrative hinges entirely on sound. The flat has become oppressive. The three lodgers eat in perfect, unnerving silence. The text specifically notes that the chewing of their teeth could be heard above everything else.
It's gross and animalistic, even though they are the supposedly civilized humans in the room.
But cutting through that chewing silence comes the pristine, melancholy sound of Greek's violin.
Gregor hasn't heard music in months. The sound exerts this magnetic pull on him. He crawls out of the darkness covered in dust, dragging threads and hairs and food remains on his back.
He keeps his head close to the ground, desperate to catch his sister's eye.
He actually asks himself, was he an animal if music could captivate him so? It's the most tragic irony of the book. His deepest surge of human feeling, his appreciation for art, is exactly what exposes him to the lodgers and seals his doom.
The pure sound of the violin draws the filthy reality of Gregor out into the light. Hearing that scene described in audio makes you feel the irresistible, fatal pull of the music right alongside him.
It makes you ask, what happens to our most fundamental relationships when we can no longer perform our designated roles? We have to move beyond the basic trope of saying the book is merely a critique of industrial capitalism. The resonance today is much more intimate.
The text forces us to confront the conditional nature of care. When Gregor was the sole breadwinner, his value was his paycheck. The moment he requires care rather than providing it, a timer starts ticking.
Compassion requires energy. It requires resources. As their own exhaustion grows, the family's empathy depletes. They don't wake up one day and decide to be malicious. They simply run out of the capacity to care for something that gives them nothing in return.
Greet's final speech is a masterclass in cognitive dissonance. She convinces herself that the bug is no longer her brother, because if she admits it is him, she has to admit that she is abandoning a human being.
So she reclassifies him as an object so she can dispose of him without guilt.
It forces you to look at your own life and ask, Are my relationships based on who I am or just what I can provide? If you woke up tomorrow completely unable to fulfill your role, unable to work, unable to parent, unable to be the strong one in your friend group, how long would the people around you keep bringing you the metaphorical milk and bread before they started pushing the rotting cheese into your room with their foot?
We like to believe familial love is an immutable force, but Kafka suggests that under enough economic and physical stress, human empathy is fragile. It's entirely dependent on our environment and our resources.
And the final paragraph of this book proves that theory. It is one of the most chilling endings in literature. After Gregor's agonizing death, the charwoman essentially sweeps his body away with the trash.
She comes in smiling, the ostrich feather on her hat swaying, and tells the family they don't need to worry about how to get rid of it.
The family doesn't mourn. They write excuse letters to their employers, fire the charwoman because her crassness broke their fragile peace, and leave the apartment.
They take a tram ride out into the open country. The tram is flooded with warm sunshine. It reads like a scene of rebirth and relief.
They lean back in their seats, discuss their prospects, and realize their finances are actually quite stable. They all have promising jobs now. They merely need to move to a smaller, cheaper flat to shed the last remnants of Gregor's memory.
And then Kafka delivers the final provocation. The parents look at Greed. Despite her recent worries and pale cheeks, they realize she has blossomed into a well-built and beautiful young lady.
They agree, communicating silently through glances, that it will soon be time to find a good man for her.
As the tram stops, Greet is the first to get up, stretching out her young body. The cycle of exploitation isn't over. It has simply shifted targets.
Gregor was consumed by the family, used up until he was a dry, flat husk. Now that he's gone, Greet is the family's new asset.
Finding a good man for her is their next financial strategy. Her youth and beauty are capital to be traded. She's stretching her body, completely unaware that she's stepping into the exact same trap that crushed her brother. The machine keeps grinding.
The specific nightmare of turning into an insect is absurd, but the nightmare of being consumed by the demands of your life is entirely universal. We wrap up this deep exploration with an invitation to you.
Return to the Clarin Horatio audiobook of The Metamorphosis.
Put on your headphones. Listen closely to the hisses of the father, the slamming of the wooden doors, the heavy boots of the chief clerk, and the relentless mechanical ticking of the clocks. Experience Kafka's unsettling masterpiece with fresh ears. And the next time you wake up in a panic because your 5:00 a.m. alarm didn't go off,
just take a second to make sure you still have hands to turn it off.